1-3-3-1-1-3. Initiating broadcast of Fascinating Nouns in 3, 2, 1.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Fascinating Nouns. Now, if you are listening to this transmission, we are still the galaxy's most trusted source for incredible people, places, things, and ideas. Now, together we arrive at this curious nexus point, and we will explore the strange, unusual, offbeat, bizarre, intriguing, interesting, invigorating, quirky, quaint, quizzical, weird, wild, wacky, the fun, the frivolous, and the fringe, plus all the spaces in between. I am your host, Daniel J. Glenn. Hello, Fascination. Welcome to the show. So while I may be the master of film and television, I am not the master of horror. You know, nah, not Stephen King. I'm talking about the original master of horror, Edgar Allan Poe, who is quite a mysterious man. And we're going to talk about that mysterious life with an appropriately titled book, Mystery of Mysteries, The Death and Life of Edgar Allan Poe. And we're going to get into some of the obscure little pieces that author Mark Dwodziak came up with during his research. It's going to be a fun ride. I can't wait to talk about one of my favorite authors of all time. No, I'm not talking about Mark, but maybe he will be on that short list soon. I'm talking about Edgar Allan Poe. So let's get into this. Mark, thank you so much for being on the show today.
You know, there's no better opening, and I wish we had caught it on film, for a man who wrote the book, wrote a book about Poe's death and life, and that is coming out of that creepy back door behind you. I'm going to put it up here for those watching on YouTube. You kind of came out of that back door with Poe's face, like you were, you know, coming out of Dracula's lair. You've also written a book on Dracula. You are no stranger to horror. You know, you got kind of a, you know, you wrote a novel on Kolchak the Night Stalker, right?
I did, Grave Secrets.
Yeah.
That's one of my, one of my favorite books, one of my favorite exercises was that novel. And you know, you follow your passions is what you do. And if you do, you are rewarded for it.
Absolutely true. I did a whole episode on the history of that television series, one I was unfamiliar with, despite my love of the supernatural serial. This kind of runs in your blood here, you know, with when you have a lot of horror stuff. You know, you also wrote a book called Everything You Need to Know I Learned from the Twilight Zone, one of my favorite shows of all time. You know, so there's a little bit of, I don't want to call it horror, gothic, holding, look at that. You got it ready, baby. Look at that.
I'll tell you, we didn't have this term back in the 1960s. You know, I'm 67. I own up to my age right away. Number one, look. Secondly, you know, I'm proud of every, you know, gray hair and wrinkle, and it's almost, that's all there's up there right now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I grew up in the 60s, and we didn't have the term. Now we call people who sort of grew up with this kind of shared childhood of watching Universal monster movies on TV and waiting for the next Hammer horror film or Roger Corman film to show up in the theater and building Aurora monster models. All my 13 original monster models are right over there.
Oh, cool.
And you got, and you're getting the magazines like Famous Monsters and Castle of Frankenstein, and you watched The Twilight Zone and The Outer Limits and Dark Shadows and all those things in the 60s.
Yeah.
Now we call those people monster kids. That's the sort of the term we have for somebody who had that. We didn't have that term back then. Back then, we just were horror fans.
Right.
You know? So, you know, I became a horror fan or a monster kid at the age of 7 when I saw a movie called Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Yeah, classic.
And it was really Lugosi's performance as Count Dracula in that movie that turned me into a horror fan at the age of 7. And I immediately set out to see anything and everything I possibly could, and started to read everything. So, you know, Edgar Allan Poe came along for the ride right away. At that time. Poe is a writer I've carried throughout my entire life. But my first book was published in 1982, was a slice of theater history. It was about the Barter Theater in Abingdon, Virginia, which is this historic and very haunted theater. And a lot of actors got their start there. Gregory Peck, Ernest Borgnine, Ned Beatty, Patricia Neal, all these great actors got their start there. And it's a very colorful theater. And that book was published in 82. Now, if you had asked me in 1982, when that book was about to come out, and said, you know, well, what's your next book going to be? I would have told you exactly what my next book was going to be.
Oh, yeah?
And I would have told you, because I was already at work on it. See, it's going to be a history of the Twilight Zone.
Okay,
why not me?
Yeah.
I mean, it's my favorite TV show of all time. In 2015, I start showing The Twilight Zone to my daughter. I start sharing it with my daughter. She had already seen Night Gallery. She had already loved Night Gallery, and she'd already seen a lot of classic television. She loved classic television. I didn't force it on her because you can't force it on, you know, if you, sure. That's the surest way to make sure they don't like it.
Right,
is
yeah.
To force it on them.
Sure.
But she discovered it. So when Becky Tur was about 14, 15 years old, I said, all right, you have done your undergraduate work in classic television. It is time to start your postgraduate work. It's time to get really serious. It's time for you to enter the Twilight Zone. So we started a forced march through all 156 episodes of the Twilight Zone.
Jesus.
And we started right with the pilot, and every night we would watch one or two episodes. And we got into the first season. There's an episode called Escape Clause with David Wayne, who plays a hypochondriac. And he wants to live forever and have immortality. And the devil appears and has him sign a contract. Now, if you know anything about the Twilight Zone, you know this is not going to end well for David Wayne. This,
right.
You know, this is going to be very bad, you know. And when the episode was over, and things did not turn out well for David Wayne, I turned to Becky and jokingly said, let that be a lesson to you.
Mm-hmm.
Always look for loopholes. Read contracts carefully. Look at, right. And we laughed, and it was a joke. And then I thought for a second, I thought of all the people who had signed bad contracts during the housing crisis and everything. And I said, you know, I actually mean this. Well, this became a running gag. We'd watch a Twilight Zone, and I would say, you know, let that be a lesson to you, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
Because I can run a gag into the ground with the best of them. And when it was over, when we were about maybe like 5 or 6 episodes down the line, and I kept saying, let that be a lesson to you, the penny finally dropped. And I said, this is it. This is your Twilight Zone book, stupid. This is the book. Now the universe is, now you're ready to write that book. That book you wanted to write 30 years ago, here it is. That's what the Twilight Zone is. It's life lessons. Mm-hmm. It's morality tales. It's parable storytelling. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is extract those, put them in a book. So the title is not exactly facetious. Everything I need to know, I learned in the Twilight Zone. It's an examination of the Twilight Zone as life lessons and morality tales. And I got the book from sharing it with my daughter from that. And but if it hadn't been for Kolchak, if it hadn't been for that setting me on that path, I doubt I would have ever gotten to that book. So I finally got my Twilight Zone book. You know, after all those years, I finally got my Twilight Zone book. It came in a direction I could not have planned. You know, you cannot plan that kind of a route, that kind of a circuit. The universe was smarter than I was. The universe was saying, no, 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 no. You know, so every time somebody says, what's your next book going to be? And I say, you know, well, I think it's going to be this. I have invariably been wrong. And, you know, that was even true about Poe, you know, because the Poe book comes out of the Twilight Zone because I had done the Twilight Zone book for St. Martin's. Every 2 years, like clockwork, we seem to get this book. And it's the book that purports to definitively solve the identity of Jack the Ripper. We get this book every day. Now there'll be another one. Just stand still long enough. There'll be another one that's going to be coming along.
Well, I did a whole episode on Jack the Ripper. I talked to one of his relatives who believes he has solved Jack the Ripper's mysterious death. Who he was. Claims he's H.H. Holmes. I did a whole episode on H.H. Holmes. So there's lots of tried and true. There's a trail here for all of this. But so Poe's interesting because your book. I want to talk about your book just a little bit because it's I want to talk about the kind of approach that you take, which is interesting because you kind of have a Quentin Tarantino aspect to it, right? Like it's told out of order. There's basically the last maybe month of his life is split up into 5 sections and interspliced. You kind of have flashbacks of the beginning, how he started. And it's all kind of in a very cinematic way, building up to his death, which is a mystery. You know, you talked about how it's super mysterious and it fits his life. In other interviews you've done, you kind of say that his death is both a great mystery story and a horror story, just like good and poetic, which is all the things he was known for. So that's where you start. And I know that you didn't really want to write a book about the death of and come up with anything definitive. But talk right. A little bit about, you know, at that point when you've got this idea. How do you end up with what you ended up with? Because it is different. It is different.
And that was my goal right from the start. I did not want to write a traditional biography of Poe.
Yeah.
Mostly because there have been a lot of traditional biographies of Poe that basically, if you want a biography that takes Poe A to Z through his life, birth to death, there are a lot of good options out there for that approach.
And there's nothing new. I don't mean to cut into. There's absolutely nothing new. He died 100 and, you know, before the Civil War. So it's not like there's any new information coming up in someone's
1849.
Attic.
1849.
Yeah.
1849. So I decided I would take a lot of chances with this book, and not the least of which was the alternate timeline that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Is the fact that the chapters alternate between the chapters about the last months of his life, when clearly something is going wrong, and those chapters lead up to his death, and then they alternate with the sections about his life, and then those two timelines meet at the end. That was one chance I took with the book.
Yeah.
And I always tell people who are going to buy the book, I always tell them about that. It's almost like the Surgeon General report on the warning on the book to say, look, you know, if you want a more traditional biography, this is not it, mm-hmm. you know. And the second thing I did was I did interviews.
Yeah,
for the
right.
book, you know, as you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do you do interviews for somebody who died in 1849?
it's not easy.
Nobody around who knew him.
Yeah.
But I approach this like a detective on a case. Like I was investigating not only Poe's life, but his death. And so the people I interviewed, I are like expert witnesses. I was a journalist for 43 years. I cannot pretend to be a kind of writer I'm not. I can only be the writer I am. So what journalists do is they do interviews. Mm-hmm. So I took almost a documentarian's approach to this.
Yes.
And I talked to Pope, people who are specialists in minute areas of Poe's life, just little aspects of his work or his biography or the places he lived. And then I talked to forensic pathologists and forensic anthropologists and medical historians, yep. and an FBI agent and police. These were my witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
This was, you know, and I put the evidence to them and I asked them. And so there are voices going throughout the book, which make to me the book come alive, you know, because I wanted those voices to be very current voices. And I went to all these people and I asked them all right from the start, don't talk to me like you're some academic talking to another academic. Put this the way you would just as if you were in casual conversation, how you would put this. And from this came gold. And as soon as somebody said something exactly the right way, my mind went like, that's going in the book. Mm-hmm. That's gold.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So those were the interviews, which is, again, because people don't do interviews for somebody who died in 1849. You're supposed to do all your research in archives and things like that.
Right.
And I did.
Yeah.
I did do that research. But on top of that research, I did these interviews. And it's one way the book is very non-traditional. So I had never heard the Tarantino comparison before, but in essence, you know, Tarantino made non-traditional films, and I guess that's true. As I was after doing a non-traditional biography.
Well, it's structured exactly like Pulp Fiction or Memento. You know, on my other show, you know, I am known as the master of film and television. So there's very little about film and TV that I can't compare things to, and that's one because you start out with the death and you slowly work back a month. And then you start at the life and then they kind of meet in like September of 49-ish, right? Like
right.
that's kind of,
that's right.
So you're kind of slowly walking back, slowly, you know, running forward. But I think it's just an interesting way to tell the story because, you know, you are making points throughout. Because you're really, in a lot of ways, this is a mystery. At least I read it like this. You know, my interpretation was this is a mystery novel. We have this strange death. Why is it so weird? And what are possible answers? With the full caveat that this is all speculation. And while reading the book and trying to solve that mystery, you are learning not only about Poe as a writer and as an artist, but as a person and the things that are true and not true. And how, you know, this is, we love nowadays to look back at history with this eye of how right we are, especially socially, how great we are now and how terrible things were even 20 or 30 years ago. And you can't do that. You can't pull things out of context like that. And I think with Poe, as you make many times in your book, he's kind of a caricature now that we all, when we're looking back at him, everything still kind of has that tint And I think you do a great job of kind of wiping that away and giving a very full view and explanation as to why people feel that way. And I like that. I thought was great.
Yeah. And I'm as guilty of it as anybody. I love the sort of the stereotype we've made of, do I have a Poe action figure? Yes, I do. You do. You know, do I have all the trappings and everything? Well, yes, that Poe is fun.
Yeah.
That Poe is great fun. Yeah. But that Poe is also a caricature.
100%.
It is a funhouse mirror reflection of who he actually was. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I wanted to do with the book was, you know, right from the start, I did not buy that Poe as the guy who wrote the horror stories. The things we know him for and the things that, of course, sort of typecast him. If you know any actual horror writers or horror directors or horror actors, you get to know certain things about them, which is, by and large, they tend to be very down-to-earth people.
Okay.
You know?
Sure.
That's number one.
Okay.
Number two, they all tend to have great senses of humor, you know, which is Stephen King said to me, you know, that, well, of course, it's standard equipment if you do a horror. You have to have a sense of humor or else you'd go crazy. If you write this stuff, the sense of humor keeps you grounded, and they're flip sides of the same coin.
Yeah, I was going to say
humor and horror.
That's the reason.
They're twins.
One's a punchline, and one's like a plunge of a knife. Like they're basically the same buildup, right? You're still building tension, and you either twist it with a joke and a punchline, or you twist it with a knife in someone's back.
Sure, but even beyond that, they are the two metaphoric storytelling devices we use to approach difficult subjects we don't like to think about.
Sure, yeah.
You know, most of comedy is rooted in pain, and, you know, and horror always deals with the big things, the big story.
Right, right.
So, you know, they are constantly reflecting each other, and they're the two story forms that don't get a lot of respect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know,
yeah,
I've said this before, but, you know, the great mystery writer John D. MacDonald once said in his introduction to Stephen King's first group of short stories, and John D. MacDonald was thought of as a writer's writer, but he said that, they're the two forms that get the least respect, and they're the two hardest forms to write. It's widely acknowledged among writers.
Yeah, right.
The two hardest forms to master, and there have been very few true masters of either form, horror or humor. And he said, and this basically comes down to that in the wrong hands, inept hands, the humor becomes horrible and the horror becomes humor.
Yeah, right. That's a good call.
It's a little bit of an overstatement, but it's not a bad observation.
Pretty good.
And, you know, so the one thing we deny Poe, a sense of humor, is the one thing he must have had. And the more you learn about Poe, the more you realize he was very witty, he was very funny, and he wrote humor. He wrote as much humor as he did horror. We just don't read his humor anymore. So I was also getting, I just never bought, you know, having known people like Robert Bloch and Ray Bradbury and Richard Matheson and Stephen King and Anne Rice, it just struck me that Poe can't be that guy. He had to have had certain elements of his character that we do not attribute. And that is it. You know, and the photographs don't help because there are only 9 known pictures of Poe.
Yeah.
What are called daguerreotypes, and a few portraits, and that's it. And all of them come from 1842 to 1849. So they're all from the last 7 years of his life.
Yeah. Now, in fairness, that's like a quarter of his life, though. I mean, he only lived to be 40, so that is like a last quarter.
Yes.
In fairness.
But it also means we don't have no idea of what Poe looked at like 20.
No, right.
You know,
yeah, right.
Or you know, we only know about those last, and most of those images then come from the last 2 years of his life.
Yeah. Okay.
When clearly something's going wrong, when his health is starting to go off the rails. So we don't have pictures of the healthy Poe. We don't have the pictures of the hale and hearty Poe. And in daguerreotypes, everybody was told, don't smile. Because when you would go into a studio, the lens had to stay open a long time. You sat in a very uncomfortable chair, which had braces on it, which kept you in place. There was even one for your neck. So you would be in place. The lens would stay open forever. And you were told, don't smile, because it's hard to hold a smile for any length of time. But it's not so hard to smile. Seriously.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So everybody, but if you look at daguerreotypes of the time, it's not just Poe. Everybody looks constipated.
Sure, yeah.
Pictures. Everybody looks,
it's
you know.
Standard.
So, you know, we don't have candid pictures of Poe. The era of the candid photograph does not come in until the end of the 19th century. if they did exist, we would have pictures of Poe laughing. We would have pictures of Poe playing a leapfrog in the front yard and splitting his pants and laughing himself silly about it. We would have pictures of Poe playing duets with his wife. How would all of that change our image of Poe if we had them?
Well, I want to say one other thing here really quickly, because, you know, you mentioned one of the things that I think is a great point you make in the book is how we know him as a horror writer. We kind of know him as a mystery writer and then a poet and then a critic. And he actually was the opposite. Like, he was a critic, then a poet, then a mystery, then horror. And what I like about the critic part is you're talking about humor. I mean, if he lived in an era with Twitter or social media, I feel like the barbs he exchanged with some of the other writers at the time, you know, the people he was critiquing, he's kind of fit into that snarky kind of world where I think he would have been a big hit on X, you know?
No question. He was a good critic. He was a really perceptive. He didn't believe in what was called log rolling.
Okay.
Log rolling is you give me a good review, I'll give you a good review. He didn't believe in that.
A lot of that going on.
His standards were very high.
Sure.
And he also believed that American literature would not escape the long shadow of Europe in general and England in particular.
Right.
Until we found our own voices, our own Native American voices. So he's kind of out in the wilderness. He's kind of the, you know, the John the Baptist of our American literature out there calling for an original. And, you know, the person who's going to answer that call is Mark Twain. Twain's going to write in the American vernacular. He's going to have an illiterate 14-year-old boy narrate a novel. All of a sudden, you know, he almost anticipates the way for Twain as a critic. And that's amazing. He, like I said, he gets no credit at all for that, for his standards as a critic and for his pushing for higher and higher standards for American literature. And he was good, too. The literature that he championed and espoused were the ones that have lived, and the ones that he dismissed have been long forgotten.
He was right. One other thing.
He was very good.
One other thing I want to get to, because along those lines, the things that, you know, I learned in this book are really what Poe is. They are the things that he did, the trails he blazed that were forgotten, you know. And you mentioned, I think it's the Murders of the Rue Morgue is the first detective story. And that really sets the tone for Hercule Poirot. I think I'm saying that correctly. I always get that screwed up. And
Poirot.
And Sherlock Holmes. You know, I did a whole episode on Sherlock Holmes and how Conan Doyle, you know, how he found his characters. But he found a lot of inspiration here. And on top of that, the other thing you mentioned in your book, which I had, it's just a small little piece in there, Mark. And I wasn't disappointed. You can't only fit so many things in there. But I wanted to know more was how when he worked for one of the newspapers or the magazines, people would send him ciphers and puzzles and all these things to figure out, and he became a master of it and incorporated them in his stories. That, I mean, it speaks to his intelligence, but also this random thing that he did that almost no one knows about except maybe the two of us.
Well, that's exactly right, is that, you know, Poe thought he could figure out anything. He thought he could solve any puzzle. And, you know, it's like horror is about, it's a search for a happy ending, but you may not get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's always kind of this good versus evil in horror and this facing of the unknown. And maybe you'll get an answer, but maybe you won't. It is not assured. The mystery story is the assurance that there will be a solution, that there will be an answer.
Yes.
And Poe thought he was smart enough to always know what the answer was. So he's the master of both forms. He's the master of the detective story and the horror story at the same time. And those are both parts of his psyche. Those are both incredible parts of his psyche. And yes, I mean, he's the direct role. He comes up with C. Auguste Dupin, his detective, only appears in three stories.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But he's the direct model for Sherlock Holmes. And how do we know he's the direct model for Sherlock Holmes? Because Conan Doyle told us so. Conan Doyle comes to America in the 1890s when the Sherlock Holmes stories have become this sensation. And the reporters are waiting for him. They're just lurking, and they're going to get this guy. And the first press conference after he lands, some reporter snarkily says, you know, like, well, isn't your Sherlock Holmes just an imitation of C. Auguste Dupin? Isn't there an American get there first? And Conan Doyle says, yes, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
He owns right up to it.
Yeah.
You know, and then on the 100th anniversary of Poe's birth in 1909, there's a big dinner in London, and Conan Doyle gives the speech in Poe's honor, and he famously asked the question, Where was the mystery story before Edgar Allan Poe breathed the breath of life into it?
Yep.
That's, I mean, you know, and that's Doyle. Yeah. That's coming from the creator, Sherlock Holmes. And even more, out of those interviews that we were talking about that I did, if I had not done those interviews, I would not have gone the next step. Because John Douglas, the pioneering FBI agent who came with the profiling unit and all that, and the co-author of the Mindhunter series, John Douglas goes so far as to say Poe is not only the father of the modern detective story, he is the father of modern forensics, period.
Right.
And that's an amazing claim. I would have never made that link. And you need somebody like John Douglas saying that. But in essence, he's saying that, you know, Poe was the guy who said, you use the techniques of the profiler in order to get to the solution. And that's what Poe did in his stories. And that comes from the guy who always thinks he can solve the problems.
Well, what's interesting about that particular part is that John Douglas is the FBI profiler. I mean, he's a guy who created behavioral psychology when catching serial killers.
That's right.
And the forensics, that's also another part. So those are two separate things. And I believe you make the point in your book that not only did Poe create the mystery novel, but he uses forensics in kind of a better way than what was being used at the time. But I think it was in its infancy at that
point. That's right. That's exactly
and then,
right.
And then he makes the connection where he also does behavior because, you know, when you listen, I was actually, I have to admit, I didn't read the Murders of Rue Morgue. I listened to an audiobook so I could fit it in for this interview. But you, what it is, it's a list of this person said this, this person said this. And it, you know, it goes through the depositions of 15 characters that are in this mystery. And while figuring out how they behave, as well as the evidence presented, then you get the full story, which is interesting because not only is he ahead of his time with forensics, the behavioral stuff. And that's what John Douglas kind of picked up on. That's pretty impressive.
It's very impressive. I mean, and we're not even getting into the fact that Poe may have prefigured modern physics, you know, because he writes a piece called Eureka. Right. And, it, you know, a lot of people think it's kind of the – that's a little bit of an overstatement. But, you know, the thing that's what Poe had a very acquisitive mind. He was interested in everything, everything.
Well, let me ask you this, because that's it. You know, we're not going to get to anything I wanted to talk about. I'm going to throw my 13 pages of notes out the window here.
I told you, I warned you about this.
You did. You did. You know, but I think Eureka is an interesting thing to bring up. I don't think many people talk about it. But I'm trying to pull up the quote here that I have. But it's interesting because Albert Einstein reads this book and he kind of I don't, you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like he uses it not necessarily as an inspiration, but there's a lot of truth in this book that he wrote, Eureka. So can you tell me just in brief, what is Eureka about? And this is also one of probably the most unknown of Poe's stories. It was not well received at the time, and yet it inspired or at least influenced Albert Einstein. This is a weird story, and I loved it. I thought it was great.
It is, and it's Poe trying to basically create a theory of unity for the whole universe.
Yeah, right.
And using not just what was known about science at the time, but also using principles of poetry. And he's looking for symmetry.
Right.
He's looking for some kind of grand design, and that's what Einstein finally is looking for. You know, it is basically, you know, to claim Poe as a scientist is an overreach. Poe is not a trained scientist, but he's got the idea of it. He's sort of putting the idea out there of this. And it's just, again, it's an amazing how many ways this guy's mind worked. One of the reasons that Poe is a very lonely person in some ways. And I think one of the reasons that made him so lonely was because he knew he was a genius. He was aware of his own genius, and he was also aware that it was not appreciated in his time. He knew he was better than everybody else. Yeah. He knew it.
Yeah.
And he knew, you know, there's this story in the book, and it's my favorite story about Poe completely.
Okay.
But it's the story about after he completed The Raven. He finished The Raven. He was living in New York. He started The Raven in Philadelphia, and then he finished it when he was in New York. And he was living at this farmhouse in Midtown Manhattan, which was then farmland. Anything above a certain point, all of New York City was there in the lower part of Manhattan. So he goes for a walk, and he encounters this young friend of his from Kentucky, another poet named William Ross Wallace. And Wallace hails him and says, Poe, how are you doing? And Poe says, great, I am doing great. I have just completed the greatest poem ever written.
Yeah.
And how do you, what do you say to that?
Right, right.
What, how do you respond to that? Wallace says something like, oh, well, that's nice. Yeah. And Poe says, no, 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 you don't understand. This is the greatest poem ever written. Do you want to hear it? And here it is, the first public performance of The Raven to an audience of one on a street corner in New York.
Right.
He recites The Raven to Wallace, and when he's done, once again, what do you say? And Wallace sort of says, well, you know, that is really fine. Yeah. And Poe roars, fine? Fine? Yeah. That's all you can say is fine? This is the greatest poem ever written. The point is, Dan, he knew. Yeah. Now, you see, writers never know. Great writers never know. You finish something, it's all wrong. You're second guessing yourself. Oh, you know, I should have done this. I should have done that. You know, writers are bundles of insecurities. You know, Poe finishes The Raven and he knew what he had done. And that's Mozart. I mean, you know, that comes along just, I mean, that is so incredible. That speaks to Poe's loneliness.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
More than any other story that I could ever tell you. To have know what you did, but you're the only one who knows.
I mean, yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, I think we all have bouts of feeling great and thinking no one else appreciates it. You know, but it's interesting because, you know, for listeners at home, he does come after William Shakespeare, who was also known for his poetry. So to claim that you've written the greatest poem of all time is a heck of a...
Oh, and it's a standard of, you know, he certainly wrote what has become the most popular poem of all time.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, it's probably the world champion because, again, look, I do talks on Poe. Mm-hmm. I do talks on Poe all the time. Afterwards, somebody invariably, there's at least one, usually more, who comes up to me and says, you know, when I was in school, I had to memorize the first four stanzas of The Raven.
Hmm, really?
And then they do it. Then they do it. They say, you know, once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered weak and weary, and I don't stop them, I let them go. You know, let's see you do that with Longfellow. Let's see you do that with Lord Byron. Let's see you do that with Shakespeare, for that matter, mm-hmm. beyond to be or not to be.
Sure.
You know, how many people know any real Shakespeare and could do four stanzas of something?
Fair enough, yeah.
But they know, they say, because everybody gets The Raven in the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. Everybody gets The Raven, you know. The public schools, and I make this point in the book, but the public school system has been Poe's best friend. You got Poe when you were in the seventh grade.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got him in the eighth, ninth, right on through. If you took a survey course in college on English, you got Poe again. Poe gets into curriculum. He has stayed curriculum. My father, in the depths of the Depression in the 1930s, got Edgar Allan Poe. You know, and he loved it when I got Poe.
Yeah. Well, I will say this, you know, I read a lot of Poe. I read him early, third or fourth grade. I read the cask of the, I always say this wrong, Amontillado.
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 I love that story.
My favorite poster.
As a little kid, it's pretty scary to think of someone getting walled up in some deep, dark cellar. But I will tell you, I don't ever remember getting it in any official curriculum. And I don't know if I feel cheated. Maybe I'm wrong. I definitely read Huckleberry Finn for sure, but I don't know that I read Poe. But I'm guessing it must be much more standard than you know. Just because I didn't get him doesn't mean the rest of the world didn't get him.
Well, I'm surprised if you didn't.
Me too.
I mean, I'm surprised if you didn't get the Telltale Heart. I mean, the Telltale Heart is basic curriculum seventh grade.
I got the Monkey's Paw for sure. I mean, probably got the Telltale Heart. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine I didn't. I'm sure. I mean, and it's a great story. One other thing that was in your book that you something you glossed over, but I picked up on it and I wrote it down because you very quickly mentioned that he challenged John M. Daniel to a duel. That never happened.
Yeah.
I know you, in the book you talk about Poe as a little surly, a little curmudgeon-y. You know, he probably...
Prickly.
Precocious. Yeah, prickly. Yeah, I think he kind of ran his mouth off at a time when maybe he could get away with it. But I'd love to hear how he ended up challenging someone. I mean, was this like old style? You take your glove and you whack someone in the face and then someone's got to go down. How did this go? What happened here?
Is that and then he goes back a year later and he and Daniel are friends. Daniel actually attends
guys
and
work.
Writes a good review of this, you know. I think, you know, when he challenges Daniel, Daniel realized Poe was not in good shape and didn't follow up on it just because it would have been dishonorable to follow up on it because Poe, you know, was drinking at that time, and he was not in good shape, and Virginia had died, and he was sort of out of control. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the last 2 years of Poe's life is kind of silly.
Sure.
You know, there are all these women. He's courting all these women during those last 2 years. His life has really gone off the rails after Virginia dies in 1847, his wife. And so, you know, I think that really speaks well about Daniel, because I think he really does sort of think, you know, no. I mean, to pursue this duel would be dishonorable.
Sure.
And, you know, it's always about code of honor and things like that. And again, Poe goes back a year. He's in Richmond that year, but he goes back the following year and there's no trouble. You know, there's no trouble. I mean, trouble is with, you know, William, with English, you know, that's the trouble, you know, you know, that's the one that could have gone to a duel and did go into court, you know.
Sure. Yeah. A wimpy man's duel is how I like to describe that.
Every once in a while, Thomas Dunn English, you know, somebody will say to me, you know, who do you think he was walling up in the cast of Amontillado? And I said, well, that's a little, you know, it's a little simplistic to sort of to say, you know, okay, this definitely parallels point to point. But if I had a candidate as to who it was, I'd say it was Thomas Dunn English that he was walling.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. Well, you touched on something else that I think goes completely against character for Poe. And that's, I don't want to say he's a ladies' man, but he kind of, I mean, first of all, his lady stuff's weird. It goes against type. He marries his 14-year-old cousin, which is odd, even for the
first cousin.
All right, thank you. Thank you. That's very important clarification. Now we're not talking kissing cousins here, Mark. We're talking first cousins. So he marries his 13-year-old first cousin and seems to be in love. They're married until till she dies. And then he's got, I think it's Fanny Osgood, who's like kind of married, but coming after him. And there's some salacious letters that go back and forth, a little, you know, hot under the collar, a little steamy.
There's flirtation.
Yeah. You know, some erotic for the time, I'm sure. Lots of ankles being shown and wrists kind of thrown about. But this becomes some kind of an issue. And then there's several women involved there. And then later on, towards the end,
it's a soap opera.
It totally is. You mentioned three other people, you know, Louis Hsu, Sarah, Helen Powell Whitman, Nancy Locke, Haywood Richmond. There's three girls towards the end, as you mentioned. Is his love life, what I'm saying, it was out of control and not at all what you
expect. His childhood sweetheart comes back into it. Then Elmira Royster, his childhood sweetheart comes back.
Yeah.
Elmira Royster at the end, and he's engaged to her.
Yeah. He's knee deep, Mark, and it's surprising.
If you look at this and you could accuse Poe of what we would now call caddish behavior, you would not be wrong. You would not be wrong.
Dog.
However, there's also the point that, you got to go back to Virginia and him marrying Virginia. Because there's nothing in Poe's biography to modern audiences that sounds ickier than the fact that he marries his 13-year-old first cousin.
Now, pretty bad.
One thing you have to realize about the time was, number one, child brides were not uncommon in the 1830s. Number two, marrying your first cousin was not uncommon. And there's still states where that's legal. There's still several states where that's still legal. And certainly a lot of rich families, they did marry their first cousins.
Sure.
You know, so that's the, but you put those two together and a modern audience hears that. And, you know, but one of the things you have to know is that there's a third person involved here, and that is Virginia's mother, Poe's aunt, who becomes his mother-in-law. She offers up no objections to this union. In fact, she supports it, and she lives with them. They are a family of three.
Mm-hmm. Right.
She lives with them until, you know, Virginia's death and then Poe's death. She is the devoted mother, and she approves. This is a very loving, devoted family, the three of them. Whatever else we don't know about Poe, because, you know, the Poe's bedroom is closed to us.
Mm-hmm.
We do not know what the nature of the relationship was. We have no idea. There's a lot of speculation, but it can never be more than speculation. But what we do know is they were devoted to each other.
Mm-hmm.
They did love each other very, very deeply on some level. And when Virginia died, and I think what Poe got even more than a loving wife and a mother figure, which he desperately needed when his own mother dies before he's 3 years old, I think the other thing that he gets out of this, he gets a stable family life. He gets the two people who give him the one thing he needs more than anything else in the world, which is unconditional acceptance and love.
Right.
And when Virginia dies, he goes nuts. When Virginia dies, he panics. He actually says in letters, and I think it's true, he says, if I do not get married again and have that, he's searching for that, what he lost when Virginia dies. He said, I won't live long. I won't live two more years if I don't find this again. So this desperate search for a wife that's in it, and it does look silly, you know, when you just read through it. But behind that search is a very real, deep psychological need that he's you can almost feel him panicking in those last 2 years as he's going from woman to woman, thinking,
that's interesting.
Will this be it? You know,
well, it's interesting because, you know, as he mentioned, he's getting desperate, and it's kind of this interesting path that he takes. And, you know, to kind of bring it back to his death, I don't want to spoil anything in the book here, but you do bring a couple of really interesting thoughts, because as Poe's going through life, and I know this was the time, tuberculosis was a nightmare of a disease, mm-hmm. but everyone around him, basically besides him, or Muddy, his mother-in-law, they all die of tuberculosis. And it's, you know, it's almost like this plague that follows him, and everyone who's, you know, even you mentioned, I forget the name escapes me right now, but there's a woman that he was infatuated with, someone's mom when he was a kid. She dies. His mom dies. I think his fostered mother dies of tuberculosis.
Yes.
So everyone, kind of like a pestilence, like the Mask of the Red Death through his life. It's all tuberculosis. I know that wasn't uncommon. But, you know, it seemed like a lot, even for one man as dark as Poe, and helped set his character for sure.
Oh, sure. Loss and the loss of women.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And idealized women. I mean, there's an awful lot of, you know, it's somebody once said that the women in Poe's poems, you know, are idealized, and the women in his short stories are scary.
Okay, sure,
you know, always come back scary. But yeah. The one thing they have in common is they all die. You know, is sure. Annabelle Lee is about a woman who's dead. The Raven is about a woman who's dead. Lygia is about a woman who dies. Morella is about a woman who dies. It runs through all his, but you can overstate that too, sure. Is the fact that a lot of women died young. Poe was not alone in losing, you know, I mean, women died in childbirth because doctors didn't know about germs or wash their hands. There were so many things that could carry people off. And it was also, Poe's interest was in morbid things. The whole country was. It was the rise of the death culture in the 1820s and 30s.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, it's like what you said before. We tend to take a 21st century yardstick and try to apply it to another time. Right. And the things will never measure up. You'll always get the wrong measurements when you do
that.
You know, even if you go back just 10 years, your measurements are going to be off, you know, so because people tend to think, oh, well, they didn't live up to our standards.
Yeah.
You know, well, guess what? 10 years, you're not going to live up to the standards of somebody 10 years from
right.
now. You know, so it's
wild. I was just watched this movie. It's called something killer, totally killer. And so it's this spoof on the serial killers, or a person from, you know, 2023 goes back to the 80s and is trying to solve, you know, a serial killer, you know, like a slasher film, right? But it's so funny because it's actually a comedy about this, you know, this Gen Z person who's so used to how things are now, going back to the 1980s when there's bullies and there's parties and it's not the same world. And it's just a fish out of water stuff. And it's, my childhood, right? And it's like, wow, man, things really have changed. But the last thing I want to talk about here, one thing that I think is really important, and you talk about it being the thing that kind of sets basically Poe's image, is, you know, his caricature, you know, his brand, for left, for a stupid corporate term, is the obituary by Griswold. And there's no greater name. I've lost it. Griswold.
Rufus. Rufus Griswold.
Dude, what is that? I mean, you know, this is not the Griswold from, you know, Christmas Vacation. These aren't those Griswolds. This is a guy who, you know, who is Poe chooses him as the master of his literary estate when he dies. And then he just shreds him in the obituary. So tell me just a little bit about this and how that even today sets the tone for how we view him, you know, from so long ago.
Yeah, well, Poe dies, you know, on October 7th of 1849. He's buried the next day. on October 8th, and then on October 9th, the obituary appears, and it buries him yet again, because Griswold, who Poe thought was a friend, was really nursing grudges for years against Poe, was jealous of Poe, was envious of him, and disapproved of him, too. And so he writes this scurrilous obituary, which is just full of slander and lies of against, and he hurls everything he can. And he did damage to Poe's reputation, which has not been undone to this very day.
That's crazy.
And he's not done. Griswold continues to, you know, Griswold's the great villain, and he's got the best name for it. I mean, Rufus Griswold sounds like a villain out of a Victorian melodrama. Sure. You know, yeah. It almost seems like it could come with a guy twirling his mustache and evicting the widow and orphan. Ah, Rufus Griswold. You know, but you know, the irony is the intended target of Griswold is Poe. In some ways, he hits Poe, but the bullet goes through Poe, bounces, and comes back and hits him. Because if anybody knows the name Rufus Griswold today, it's because of Poe. Mm-hmm. He's only known because in the reflection of Poe, and then he's known as this awful, terrible person who did this awful, terrible thing to Poe. But he did do incredible damage to Poe, to Poe's reputation. And it's really been the first real great biography of Poe was published in around 1940, the Arthur Hobson Quinn biography. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, and that's, you know, so that is about 80 years ago. It's been 80 years of people trying to correct the biographical record of Poe.
Okay. Yeah.
So it's an ongoing effort to restore the image. And I don't want to say restore it so much as to bring balance to it.
Right.
You know, I don't even really much, if somebody wants to indulge in the caricature of Poe and the fun Poe and all that, I really, because again, it is fun. And it is one of the things that have kept him alive. It's helped keep him going as the caricatures kept, you know. I'm not really, you know, I don't really object to that that much. But when you get into the discussion of the real literary artists and who the guy was, why was he so good at writing those horror stories that we love so much? Mm-hmm. Now you have to grapple with the real Poe. Now you have to get behind the stereotype.
Right.
It would be as if we, you know, you created a stereotype of Stephen King, that you like from one of his commercials or one of his movies where, you know, you had the guy with a candelabra and a bat on his shoulder and things like that. So, well, that's the guy who created The Shining. Yeah. It's like, no, the guy who goes to the Boston baseball games and, you know, is a great family man. And is that's the guy who wrote The Shining. That's the guy who wrote The Stand. You know, and that's the same thing with Poe. You have to get to the real person at that point.
Well, and I think that that's really important. You know, and Rufus Griswold is going to join the ranks of Jack McCall as infamous people. You know, he's the guy who killed Wild Bill Hickok, shot him in the back of the head. You're going to
Aces and eights,
baby, Dead Man's Hand. So you end up, you know, that's how he kind of becomes famous. And you're right. You know, and I think you do a great job in this book of painting that full picture and giving reasons as to why. In some ways, that's, you know, part of the book is really explaining how Poe became the artist that he is. But I also think there's a second part, which is the mystery of his death, which you do talk about. You start, I mean, it starts out with a, you know, not with a bang, but with a death knell. I don't know, yell, scream. I don't know. He dies is what I'm trying to say. It starts there and you kind of figure it out. So there's a lot going on here. And I think it's a great book. So how can people get in touch with you? How can people find the book and learn more? You know, and obviously you're dressed like Mark Twain. So that can't be a coincidence. So
it is. You know, the thing is, I've been playing Mark Twain on stage for 45 years. I started when I was 22 years old.
Wow.
But when I was 22 years old, it took me 2 hours to look like this. And I've got pictures of myself in front of the makeup mirror, making myself up to look exactly like this. Now, what I was doing was I was showing what I was going to look like when I was 67 years old.
Yeah.
I did not know that this was makeup by proxy. Right. But I love this because, you know, five of my books are about Mark Twain, and I've been playing Mark Twain, and there's a whole part of my life where I'm kind of known as a half-ass Mark Twain scholar.
Sure.
Or something.
Yeah.
And I love, every once in a while, somebody will come up to me and say, well, are you doing this on purpose? And I said, yes. I went back in time and had my DNA arranged. So when I was 67, I would look like, no, I'm not doing this on purpose. You can't do this on purpose.
You can get a buzz
this
cut.
Is just what
you
happened.
Can get like a marine cut. You can shave the mustache. Come on here, Mark. Don't BS me here. I'm smarter than that.
But my hair naturally does this. I inherited this hair from my mother and father. Polish and Swedish, Italian side, all went this way. There's not a thing I can do about this. I've had the mustache since I was around 24.
Okay.
But when I was 24, Dan, nobody was confusing me with Mark Twain. I had this exact same mustache. Do you know who I did get back then? I used to get Groucho Marx. People, because my hair was black. My, you know, I had the mustache, mustache, and people would say, you know, well, you look a lot like Groucho Marx, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, I see it now.
You know, nobody said Mark Twain. As soon as the hair went white,
yeah,
they said Mark Twain.
Yeah.
So, you know, and again, I used to spray this stuff in. I used to get the makeup out, some, you know, put it in and all that
stuff.
The
whole thing.
Yeah. The eyebrows. You know, this makeup process is down to about 5 minutes at this point, you know?
No, it's very realistic. At least you got the, at least it's not a wig, right? So that's the good part. At least you're not wearing a wig. Nope. So, you know, that's good news.
Nope. I still do Poe. You know, I still do Poe. I just, you know, for Poe, I wear a different costume. I wear the black, red velvet. Sarah does this with me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't not look like me, you know.
Yeah, so, right. That's fair. You know, it's fair.
So I don't try to look like Poe when we do. But, you know, again, Poe died at 40, you know, for me to try to shave off 27 years.
Right. Even this era of modern medicine, that is tricky. The book, how can people find the book? How can people, your website, social media, how are you doing?
Yes. It's at markdewitziek.com. My website is very, very tricky. It's just myname.com. So that's very easy. The books are at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, you know, your favorite bookstore of choice. As a matter of fact, this was just named yesterday, the nonfiction book of the month. At Barnes & Noble.
I saw that. So that's fantastic.
It's all over Barnes & Noble right now. And the paperback just came out this week. So you have hardcover and paperback, depending on what format you like. So it's very easy to get, very easy to find. And, if you have any doubts at all, just go to my website. There are links to Barnes & Noble and Amazon all over it.
I'll make sure I had that on my website as well. And again, the book's called A Mystery of Mysteries, The Death and Life of Edgar Allan Poe. And you can find this show. It's FascinatingNouns.com. And we are on X, formerly Twitter, at Fascinating Noun, and on Facebook, at Fascinating Nouns. So this has been so much fun, Mark. Thank you for taking me a trip down the kind of the obscure moments in Poe's history. Because even though you say he's a caricature, Mark, in some ways, he is just as weird and quirky as we think he is. I think just in different ways, but this book definitely shines a light on it.
Oh, he's weird and quirky, but so are we all.
Sure. No, certainly. But you know, this great book. So I encourage everyone to go and grab it. So thank you for that. And thanks for being on the show today.
My pleasure. Always fun to talk about Poe, and I enjoyed it.
Thank you. And I want to thank everyone for listening. Have a good night. Fascinating Nouns is a Glencoe production and is hosted and produced by me, Daniel J. Glenn. The show producer for this episode was Sarah Brandt. The Fascinating Nouns introduction was produced by Daniel J. Glenn and E.A. Barrientos, with music and sound design written and performed by E.A. Barrientos. And I'm guessing after listening to this, you never want to miss another episode. You're going to want to subscribe. We are on all of your favorite podcasting platforms, and we even have links right there on our show website, which is fascinatingnouns.com. You can find all the links right there. And let's say you don't have a favorite podcasting platform. That's no problem. You can listen to every episode right there on the website, which is once again fascinatingnouns.com. And while you're there, don't forget to sign up for our newsletter. It's a great way to learn more about the episodes that you're listening to, find out about upcoming episodes, and to just keep in touch with the community. It's right there on the website. And speaking of community, there's no better way to stay in touch than on social media. And you can find links to our show's Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and YouTube pages right there on the front page of FascinatingNouns.com. And speaking of YouTube, there's a video version of this episode there right now, as well as other past episodes and all future episodes. It's going to be right there, youtube.com/Daniel J. Glenn. It's a great way to see all the guests and, you know, check it out live and in person. Feel like you're there in studio. Great way to do it. youtube.com/Daniel J. Glenn. And finally, if you like this show, you're going to like everything that I do. Go to danieljglenn.com and check out all of my projects and see what's going on. Once again, thank you for listening.
End of transmission.